Welcome everyone to episode 12 of the Real MVP podcast, and I'm your host, Modern Vintage Gamer. Some of you guys may know Bob from RetroRGB.com. He was gracious enough to interview me for his YouTube channel last week, and I thought it would be a cool idea to put up the audio for that in this particular episode. We spent about an hour and 45 minutes having a discussion on all sorts of interesting topics, including the original Xbox, the modding and the hacking scene, how I got my start in the scene, as well as other discussions about YouTube and life in general. So sit back and relax for the next hour and 45 minutes, and I'll catch you guys in the next episode.
Hey everybody, I am here with Demetris from Modern Vintage Gamer. What's up, man?
What's going on, man? It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time to do this.
Absolutely.
So one thing I always try to get right is people's names. So is Demetris the correct way to pronounce your name? And do you prefer to be called Modern Vintage Gamer, from Modern Vintage Gamer? What's your correct introduction here?
You did get my name right. You didn't butcher it. So 10 points already on the board. Great job. You can call me MVG or Demetris. Either one's fine. Trying to say like Modern Vintage Gamer fast over and over again is a little hard to kind of, doesn't really come off the tongue very well. So MVG, Demetris, Shit for Brains, whatever you want to call me, man. It's all good. No worries.
That's funny. You know, I'm a bit of a hypocrite about that because getting other people's names right in these interviews is so important to me, but I could care less if anybody got my name right. The only thing that does bug me is I always made sure from day one, back when RetroRGB was a Google Doc, I always made sure that I was Bob from RetroRGB. I'm not RetroRGB because I kind of knew, like at first it was my cousin Scott and I, but it's just grown to so many people contributing. And I mean, technically, I guess you could say you're a contributor now too because of all the times I talked about your videos and learned from stuff you said. So I never wanted it to be about me, you know?
Yeah, I appreciate the love on the channel, but I was going to say, I have to admit, I've butchered your name a few times. I think I've said Retro RGB Bob or Bob Retro RGB. I don't know. Like, I've kind of mixed it around a little bit, so. But
all of that's fine.
But I appreciate the articles you guys have been posting on about me on the website. I appreciate the love for sure.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where I would always love to have you contribute if you wanted to, but I also love hearing other people's interpretations of your videos as well. So it's always an open invite, but yeah, we'll definitely cover everything that we think's relevant. Sometimes we miss a few though, like there's John Linneman just did one on Final Fantasy, and I know I'm going to probably get lynched for saying this, but I'm not a fan of those games, so I didn't know how to do a write-up.
What?
I was like,
all right, in interview's over. Let's wrap it up. I'm just kidding. No, it's Final Fantasy is definitely an acquired taste. I 100% admit it. In fact, I went back and just played the remake, and I got to say, it was good, but it wasn't. It wasn't great, and I was a little unhappy about the way that it ended. So, but what can you do?
Yeah. So I guess we should go back to the beginning, as people are wont to do, and kind of get your origin story, because I don't believe we ever ran into each other back in the day on the forums. I'm pretty sure I did Kevtris and Frank Cifaldi and them back when we were all kids, to be honest with you. But you've been around and in the scene for quite a long time, long before your YouTube channel, right?
Yeah. No, it's a good question. So my kind of roots start back in the early 2000s with the original Xbox, and the way everything kind of started off, man, was I got an original Xbox because I knew that the thing was just basically a PC, you know, all said and done. It had Celeron, it ran I think a Pentium 3 or a Celeron, and it had kind of PC parts, and it ran this kind of custom Windows kernel and stuff. And for me, the Xbox was really cool because I've always been a big fan of emulation, but before that I was emulating, you know, the NES and the Super NES on just a PC, and the Xbox was interesting to me because it was really truly the first system that I felt like if someone can figure out a way to tap into this thing from a modding perspective, this is the ultimate retro emulation box for the living room. You know, you've got the box, you've got the hard drive built in, you've got the network built in, you've got four controller ports. This is the best thing that could ever possibly happen. And surely enough, within, you know, a month or two after it came out, it was hacked pretty much. You know, Bunny had hacked the firmware and everything, and mod chips were already coming out for it. So I got on board with that, picked one up. And because I come from a coding background, I've got a computer science degree, and when I went to college, I learned C and C++ and assembly language. I've kind of felt like, you know, I'm going to have a go at this homebrew stuff and see if I can, you know, build an emulator for it or port an emulator, because I want to run Super Metroid on my Xbox in my living room, because that sounds like a really cool little project to do. So I started out doing that, and at the time I had no idea about emulation. I mean, I knew what an emulator was and I'd run them before, but I had no idea about how they worked as far as all the different internals to make an emulation piece of software work. And I also didn't know anything about the Xbox, and I didn't know anything about like the graphics API, which was DirectX. So I kind of just learned as I went along. You know, I bought this book on DirectX programming, and I bought a book on, microprocessor architecture. And with my computer science background, I was able to you know, basically port a Super NES emulator to the Xbox. And that's kind of where it all began. Like, so from there, I kind of continued on in the homebrew scenes for quite a while. I was doing the original Xbox stuff until about 2004, 2005. And then I took a bit of a break, got into the 360, and the 360 wasn't anywhere near as big as the Xbox original because it was so much more difficult to mod the system. So everyone could easily mod an Xbox, but not many people could mod a 360 because there was, you know, you got to do the JTAG and all that stuff. And Microsoft had wised up to it and patched the firmwares and everything. And really from there, it was just a continuation of the homebrew scene. Got into the PSP for a while, got into the PS3, and really kind of stopped after the PS3. I was kind of getting a little older at that time, and probably 10 years had passed, and I wasn't like a 20-something year old. I was a 30-something year old. So I was a little more nervous about what would happen, repercussions, and you know, if I got in trouble. I mean, I've got a family now, and I've got all that stuff. So I kind of stopped doing that stuff, and I kind of gravitated more into the YouTube side of things and the content creation stuff. But I still, as you know, I still dabble in homebrew. I do the occasional Switch port, just because I can, to see if I've got the chops. And I'll still do some original Xbox ports because, I mean, these days, you know, the statute of limitations is long gone. I don't think Microsoft cares if you do anything on the original Xbox anymore.
Not unless you try to, you know, sell it. That would be the only thing that they...
Right. Right. So I think, you know, it's fun. Like, I really enjoy doing that stuff and keeps me fresh and active. And it also brings another dimension to the content that I create, which is cool, because I want to kind of educate people as well as just, you know, tell a story and just kind of show something. So having that homebrew part of me and the developer part of me really kind of adds another dimension to the content. So I think it's really interesting, and I kind of gravitate between just regular content, product reviews, and then the developer stuff, the homebrew stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, 1,000 words is probably, you know, or less is probably, that's probably the best way I can describe the story.
So the Xbox for me was such a pivotable. Wow, making up words here. I blame the Johnny, but it was a pivotable. I can't even say it. A pivotal point.
Pivotal.
No problem saying Demetrius. Can't say pivotal. Okay. A pivotal point. In my emulation days, because I did grow up. My first website was called the Emulatorium. It was, you know, I was a kid, and I basically it was basically RetroRGB 1.0. I just took all the information that was scoured out there about emulators, put it all on one website, and made it really easy, you know, on GeoCities with a counter and everything, and just kind of made it a one-stop shop for people to come and get all the stuff they needed. Always credited developers, and still, you know, to this day. But I was into the emulation thing since day one, and then about the time the Xbox came out was about the time I was living on my own. And I just, there was, it opened up such a world of awesomeness, like having all the consoles on one with all the emulation, and the emulation was really high quality. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not cycle perfect. It's not going to compare to the Mister, but you know, especially at the time, it was really good. And the latency was incredibly low. And I actually used my Xboxes more for XBMC to watch movies and stream music and stuff like that. And it was also a thing that really, I don't even want to try to say pivotal again. It was also a thing that made a mark on me, because it was the first time like responsible adults that I knew hacked their Xbox. And I had so many friends that asked me to hack theirs for them because they were tired of their small children scratching up all their CDs. So these are adults that would still buy the games. They'd still, you know, as Christmas and birthday and Hanukkah, whatever presents for their kids, the kids would still open them. But part of the opening up ceremony would be to rip it to the Xbox's drive so that you wouldn't have to use the discs anymore. And so, I mean, there was just a ton of friends had me do it who still bought games. You know, occasionally, yeah, if it was something crazy or something in early release or whatever, they would go and just download it. But for the most part, these are people I know that used it legitimately and saved a lot of money and scratch discs and a lot of sped up load times as a result. So that really made a mark on me on, you know, how sometimes hacking could just... It isn't this nefarious thing where you see the pictures on like the stock photos. If you Google hacker, it's like somebody with a hoodie, like a skinny kid with a hoodie, like in a dark room, like a Monster Energy drink. Like that's not what it is. It's just getting the ability to use the hardware that you've already paid for the way you want to use it.
Yeah, it was a real fun time, you know. And I appreciate the story that you tell. Everyone's got a story about those days that was there. And a lot of it does gravitate around XBMC or emulation and stuff. And it's really cool. It's a really cool feeling to be involved in that and a part of that. Like for me, you know, I've always said that if I'm going to work on a project, a homebrew project or an emulation project, it's because it's something that I'm interested in first and foremost. But if I can bring happiness and joy to people as well, I mean, that's an absolute bonus. But it was funny because you mentioned, you know, black hat type stuff. I mean, man, I've got emails. I still have them saved to this date where there were Microsoft employees telling me, man, we love your work. You know, keep up the good work, you know. And I think the biggest thing there was Microsoft didn't really care about the homebrew stuff. In fact, they were very much interested in some of the things that were going on. They didn't care about, you know, Xbox Live. I mean, if you started messing around with Xbox Live and cheating online, that's where they took offense, and that's where they started cracking down. But the homebrew stuff, and of course piracy. I mean, if you're pirating games, obviously that's not something that they were very fond of. Right. But if you were doing the homebrew stuff, they didn't really seem to mind. In fact, Bill Gates was quoted as saying that he wanted to learn more about XBMC and how you know Microsoft can leverage that going forward with the 360. And I kind of think they did with, I don't know if you remember the 360, but it came with some like real bog standard media player that wouldn't even play like Xvids, but later on they started adding codecs for it so you could start playing more stuff. So they did incorporate some fashion of media player in the 360, but man, I never felt like it was anywhere near as good as XBMC. Never. I mean, you can still run that. You can run that software today. I mean, as long as it's not, you know, HD 1080p content or Blu-rays, which obviously won't be read, but you can buy a DVD from Target, you know, a current movie and still play it on XBMC. And I think there's a lot to say about that, especially, you know, families that are probably lesser fortunate that don't have that much money, but they still have an Xbox in their house. I mean, using XBMC, man, that thing will get you through, you know, no problem whatsoever. You can still watch trailers. You can still run YouTube on it. There's all sorts of things you can still do on that thing. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, one of the things I remember, which is funny because I've done the same silly nerdy crap my whole life, but one of the things I remember doing was when I first got... There was one release of XBMC that really stood out from the rest. I mean, it added a bunch of codecs. The performance just went through the roof. Because I'd been using it since the first inception of it they posted. And my dad was over. He was still alive at the time. And I had just bought some fancy DVD player. I don't know if it was an Oppo or a Cambridge Audio. It was probably some... probably a different brand, but we plugged that into, I had a, just happened to be in the right place in the right time and go to Luva Akonda TV, which now, like, whatever, but at the time that was a pretty big deal. It'd be like scoring a brand new OLED for less than half price type of thing. And we plugged in the fancy DVD player. We watched like half of a movie, and then we put the same disc into the Xbox using XBMC to launch it and watch the second half. And hands down, it was better through XBMC. The deinterlacing was phenomenal. I couldn't believe it at the time. And, you know, now with the tools that we have, maybe we could reanalyze it and find out, you know, it was a filter or something. But the end result was something that you get for free on a hacked device looked better than a very expensive DVD player, which I ended up returning as a result.
Yeah. Dude, XBMC was the best. It was the ultimate media center for the OG Xbox, and I love that thing, and I think you know this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. So Cody is XBMC. You know that, right? So Cody today is XBMC.
I think you should tell the story for anybody listening that may not.
So long story short, XBMC was Xbox Media Center. It started its life on the original Xbox, and once the Xbox kind of fell out of relevancy and got superseded by more modern consoles, it still kept the name XBMC, but it had moved to Linux and Windows and maybe Mac. There were ports to that. And then when things like the Raspberry Pi started coming along, the ARM-based devices, XBMC was ported to those devices as well. But so much time had passed, I think like 10 years had passed, and they changed the name to Kodi because XBMC had ties to the Xbox, but it wasn't really Xbox software anymore because its last kind of official Xbox version was many, many years beforehand. So just to avoid confusion and, well, yeah, pretty much just confusion with the Xbox, they changed the name. But Kodi today has its roots on the original Xbox with XBMC, which is a really cool story. And it's great to see that it's still out there and going well.
It's still a really great piece of software too. My cousin still uses it as his main media center software. I used it for a long time to play 3D ISOs. It just, you know, the Oboe players that I used were better, but if you keep cost in the account of this, I mean, at the time, I think I was using a Raspberry Pi 2. And so we're, you know, if you don't need a case for it, we're talking about $50, including the SD card, versus a $500-$600 Blu-ray player. So it's, you know, it's still to this day a giant help to a lot of people, and it's compatible with everything, both on both sides, compatible with all kinds of hardware and all kinds of media that you throw at it, you know?
Yep. Yeah, it's just an awesome piece of kit, and it's one of those things that, you know, you hear stories about, do you still use the same software that you were using, you know, many years ago? And XBMC, look, I'll be honest, I don't use XBMC anymore or Kodi, but that thing is probably the longest piece of software that I've used for such a long amount of time. Like, I used it for years, man, until, you know, obviously it kind of got superseded by more modern stuff and 4K and Blu-rays and stuff like that. But it's an awesome piece of software for sure.
Absolutely. Now, isn't Plex based off of the open source Kodi part?
It could be. I'm not really that up to speed on Plex, but I would not be surprised because they did so much work on codecs and things like that, that it wouldn't surprise me that they are utilizing pieces of Kodi or XBMC for sure.
Yeah, that's, you know, I don't need a fancy interface. I like it. I appreciate it, but I just, whatever's the best way to play the files with the least amount of you know, compression or anything else. But I do appreciate Plex. And that's something I got to get back into because I started using it when it first came out and it was cool, but I just loaded it up recently a few months ago and I'm trying to reintroduce myself to it. But when you have a setup that works perfectly, it's really hard to change. You know, all you're seeing is any negativity versus what you're currently using.
I haven't used Plex in a while. I started using it when it first came out and I was impressed with the software. I don't really watch that many movies, believe it or not. Like, I'm a YouTube junkie, man. I just spend my time watching YouTube videos, honestly.
Really?
Yeah, that's really my big thing. Like, I watch all sorts of stuff on YouTube. I watch the occasional thing on Plex or Netflix, but these days, man, I just watch YouTube content.
I have such a love-hate relationship with YouTube, because there's so many people out there that are just amazing. And I would put you in that category. There's certainly people I mention all the time that I'm just really lucky to have gotten to know over the years. But there's so much garbage, and it's infinitely more so than even flipping through the TV. And the problem I have as well is when I'm trying to learn something new, there's people out there that can give a presentation like nobody's business, confident, excellent, you know, production value, video just looks like something that's wonderful. And you get to the end of it and you're like, that person had no idea what they were talking about. This doesn't work at all. They could just make a good video. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. I have a love-hate relationship with that. And I do, because I spend so much time kind of have to do YouTube. Like, I love running the site. I love doing the development, and I like making videos, but I don't love it. So I think because I'm kind of forced into that a lot, I get a little bit cynical sometimes and just, you know, only stick to watching the channels that I already know. And that's an awesome thing. Like, if you know there's a good channel and you know that, you know, that's somebody that you could trust or a group of people you could trust. If you're not in the mood to watch that video, it's totally cool. But like, I would also, on the other side of things, if there's a subject I maybe might be interested in, but somebody I trust did a video on it, I'll totally watch that just in case.
Right. Yeah, I'm the same. I've got my favorites that I kind of watch week in, week out. But I'm always big on recommendations as well. Like, people will say, check this person out, and I'll have a wander over and take a look. And it doesn't necessarily have to be about retro or emulation or modding or anything like that. It could be something completely different. Mm. And I think that's where YouTube really gets really good, because you don't have to kind of keep it within your space that you know. You know, mate, sometimes it's cool to kind of branch out and look at some other content out there. But for me, I like it, man. There's enough content out there. You're right. There is a lot of bad content. And there's no doubt about that. But man, look, sometimes bad content is entertainment too. So if I'm in the mood to watch some, you know, low quality stuff, I can get entertainment from that too. So I'm not that picky about it. Maybe you're more picky about it than I am, but yeah. I think the platform overall is pretty good.
So I always find myself, I very often don't explain things the right way. So just to be clear, it could be somebody holding up their cell phone talking. If I enjoy the content, the content. It doesn't have to be fancy looking. I just, the opposite annoys me. And I also, I prefer to watch YouTube on my TV, sitting on a couch with a beer, just kind of relaxing. So there's no like easy way to like or dislike videos that way. So all the time I'll get 3 or 4 minutes into a video and go, oh, I got duped. This is garbage, clickbait. But then videos like that will keep popping up in my feed forever afterwards. And I wish I could somehow like work that through the TV app. Like, I random stuff too. I don't know if you know Taverish, the people that work on cars. If you're into cars, that's a decent one, because they're real people. They're not like trying to put on a show, but they do a lot of pretty neat work and stuff like that. But I get sucked into it as well, but I'm a little more cynical, I guess, getting in.
Right on.
So just to stick on Xbox for just a short while longer, it's been
good, man. I love
so
it.
Long since I've hacked an Xbox, which and this is really annoying to me, because there was a time in my life where I knew every motherboard revision. I didn't even need to reference any documents. I could just look at the motherboard and know what points to solder together to do the soft mod to it. And I know I forgot all of it, every bit of it. So for somebody today with everything that's happened, all the advances, if you have a stock Xbox that's never been modded before, what do you suggest is the way to just add add some kind of soft mod and to be able to put different stuff on it?
Yeah, so back in the day, you would use like the Splinter Cell or the Agent Under Fire 007 save hack. It hasn't really changed, man. Like, they've found some newer hacks, save game hacks, like some more games have been added to the list. But otherwise, it's pretty much the same. Like, there is, I'll say, more user-friendly soft modding tools out there now, where it essentially will build the soft mod files for you without you kind of having to nerd out a little too much and not really know. Because I think the biggest criticism about soft modding is, if you're an absolute beginner and you don't know what soft modding is, you're still going to struggle with soft modding, because you're not really sure about what you're doing, you know, what soft modding is, but there's some really like literally like one click on this icon on your Windows desktop and it'll build the soft mod files for you and then just copy that to your USB stick and then copy that to your memory card and then away you go. So nothing's really changed. I mean, I'll say things are a little more user-friendly these days. It wasn't as much hacking to get the desired result, but I would say, look, if you've got an Xbox sitting in your living room and you want to mod it, the process has always been get yourself a copy of Splinter Cell or Mech Assault or Agent Under Fire, get a Xbox memory card and a USB stick and one of those cables that convert, you know, the just regular USB to the Xbox custom thing that you plug into your controller.
Right.
Probably cost you about $5 on eBay. Splinter Cell costs next to nothing. Everyone was complaining that it was going to go up in price after the soft mod files came out, but it's still about $5 on eBay. So for about $20, you can soft mod your Xbox, and a soft modded Xbox will get you pretty far. It will get you enough where you can install a custom dashboard and start, you know, open up the FTP server so you can start copying emulators and ROMs and XBMC across. But if you want to get a little more advanced, you want to do the TSOP flash, and that's where you flash the custom BIOS onto the TSOP. And for that, of course, you have to open up the system and bridge the, assuming you have a 1.5 or a lower revision Xbox, open up the read-write on the TSOP and then flash a TSOP BIOS or a custom BIOS onto the TSOP. And then from there, you don't need the soft mod anymore. And then, of course, there's still the mod chip option as well. There are people that still sell and make mod chips out there, which is, it's kind of redundant these days, isn't it? But people still prefer, you know, having switchable BIOSes that they can flick between. But yeah, I mean, I would say, look, soft modding is a pretty simple process to do. I did a soft modding guide maybe about 6 months ago now, and I'll say the thing about YouTube and doing tutorials is, like, and you know this, as soon as you drop a video on a tutorial, it's like out of date, like almost the next day. Yeah. But fortunately, the Xbox has been around long enough, and it doesn't really move that fast anymore as far as advancements or anything new. So generally speaking, there may be some broken links, but if you follow a soft modding guide, like anything from like a 2016 to a 2020 soft modding guide on YouTube, you should be able to soft mod your Xbox pretty easily.
So to break it down, soft modding is modding without changing any of the hardware. And then you yep. could flash the onboard BIOS itself, pretty much a permanent thing. And then you could alternatively add a mod chip with a switch to switch between the stock BIOS and the modded BIOS, so you don't have to worry about anything else. Yep. The only thing that I can't remember is if you want to upgrade the hard drive, do you have to flash the TSOP, or could you do that through a soft mod?
You could do that through a soft mod, but it's very limited. It's preferred that you do a TSOP flash, because one of the things you have to do is unlock your drive. What you have to do is unlock the current drive, install a new drive in. And with a soft mod, it's really picky about the type of drive that you put into it. You can do it, but it's kind of a pain in the butt to do it. If you want to put like a 2 terabyte drive in, or maybe some people do compact flash. I'm a big fan of like a compact flash, because I want my Xbox to be as quiet as possible. But of course, you can't get anywhere near the size of storage as a 2 terabyte drive. You could get, you know, maybe 128 gigabytes, which is more than enough, by the way, in my opinion. But yeah, you'll probably want to TSOP mod it, because trying to unlock a solid state drive or a compact flash device is going to be almost impossible to do. So
for the Xbox, since it's an IDE interface, any kind of converter would work. So SATA to IDE, compact flash to IDE.
Yep.
So you could really use any storage at all, as long as it's matching whatever mod that you've done to it, right?
That is correct. And that's one of the beauties about the Xbox original. It was built literally up with custom, or not without custom, with off-the-shelf kind of PC parts, really. I mean, it's just a PC when it's all said and done. The only things that don't make it a PC is obviously the BIOS and some of the... There's some custom chips in there as well, but, you know, you've got Pentium 3 processor in there. You've got IDE. You've got Master Slave in there as well. You've got a Northbridge and a Southbridge. You've got DDR memory. I mean, you've got USB. I mean, it's really just a PC. So you can take advantage of some of the cool things that you can do with a PC and literally use off-the-shelf parts like a hard drive or an IDE hard drive to get what you want.
Yeah, that's awesome. I remember all that stuff. I remember, and especially because I've always been really into PC modding and all that stuff from childhood till now. And, you know, even for 6 years, I worked for the company that made medical grade computers. So I was part of the design team that you know, built, basically worked on building a PC, you know, flew out to MSI Computer and AOpen and made motherboards with them and stuff like that. So this has been a giant part of my life from a childhood hobby all the way to an actual adult career. So it was kind of neat to start messing with the Xbox.
For sure.
Moving on to the 360, though, when I remembered that in real time, so, you know, after the fact, I think I had a modded 360 I used for a little while, but it was always more complicated. There was always a lot more going on to modding it. And now... now that some time has passed, is it any easier, or is it still where you have to, you know, to flash the chip directly and all that stuff? And
nah, man, it's still a pain in the butt. That Microsoft obviously took a lot of lessons from the OG Xbox and tightened up security very well, but they didn't make it foolproof. But essentially, what you have to do, and it hasn't changed, it's the same process. And you may remember this, but what you got to do is you got to solder in a NAND dumper to extract your current NAND, and then from there you extract the CPU key from the NAND, and then you rebuild the NAND with a custom firmware with your CPU key, because every Xbox has a unique CPU key, so it's kind of encrypted with a unique key. And then from there, you got to install your JTAG, the mod. If you're using a reset glitch chip, you got to install that chip. And then you got to flash your custom NAND onto that chip and then kind of pray it all works. So it's like a 7-step process where it requires soldering, flashing, desoldering, and then soldering of a new piece of hardware, then flashing back onto that hardware, and then hopefully it all works. So it's pretty complicated. And I think, you know, the 360 is a great system. A modded 360 is an awesome system. But I think that's what really turned a lot of people away, because number one, it was so much more complicated to mod one than just I'm going to run Splinter Cell and load up my save game. And I'm in a custom dashboard. There was a lot more to it. And then coupled with the Red Ring of Death as well, which we certainly can't forget, just made it kind of a pain in the ass where so many people just didn't really want to deal with it. And, you know, you can't really blame them. So I think the 360 is a modded 360 is a great system to have. And I'm a big fan of mine. But I also fully acknowledge that it was probably about 1/10 of the size, the modding community, of the original Xbox, because, you know, Red Ring of Death Plus, it was very complicated to mod one.
Now, do you get the performance boosts that you would on a PS3? Because one thing I certainly noticed is if you have a stock PS3, you put in a disc, you have to wait for the disc to copy to the hard drive, which takes forever. And then, you know, load times all ridiculous. Whereas if you have a modded PS3 and you know, it's obviously illegal, but you use that software to download the PSN version directly onto it, which I've done. I actually own a bunch of PS3 games and did it that way anyway. And I have an SSD in mine, and it's a noticeable difference in load times. I mean, it's a huge difference. Is that the same with the 360? So if you were to hack it, put it in an SSD, and then put the games on it like that, do you get as much of a performance boost?
Yeah, there were some things you could do with the 360 where you could drop in an SSD, which certainly helped. But I think PS3 was always faster for me in that regard. I want to say it was more optimized for the hard drive. Like, if you remember the PS3 and the Xbox, it wasn't really until much later where Microsoft would allow you to install an entire game onto the hard drive. But for PS3, from memory, I mean, you could pretty much do that from day one. And even a lot of the games would mandatory, you know, it was mandatory that those games would install themselves onto the hard drive, or at least a huge chunk of it, before you could play the game. So I always felt that the PS3 was a faster overall system as far as loading and drive speed and stuff, but you could certainly drop in an SSD into a 360 and boost its performance. Mm.
Yeah, you know, I was even pretty underwhelmed when I got an Xbox One X I had borrowed for a while, the 4K version.
Yeah.
The
One X.
Yeah, okay, I got that right. and I loaded up a 360 game, the 360 version of Mortal Kombat, just for the hell of it, and it took forever to load. You have to boot into the 360 dashboard and everything else, and I was really disappointed about that as well, that they didn't have a smarter way to kind of get to that game.
I'll tell you a little secret, Bob. I don't actually have a Xbox One X. I wasn't really big on Microsoft this generation, and not to disrespect them or to shit on them, but I just felt like the Xbox One was a bit of a misstep for me. You know, the 360 was their last greatest system, and I think the Series X will. It seems like on paper it's going to be a return to form, but we'll see what comes out of it. But yeah. I'm not a big fan of that, man. Like, I just felt like, you know, even though we're getting more and more powerful technology, everything seems to be getting slower. And I'm really glad to see that both Sony and Microsoft are taking a lot of notice when it comes to drive performance. And I think they're really pushing SSDs and fast SSDs for the next generation, which is absolutely the right thing to do, because it's not just about how many, you know, triangles per second or polygons per second can be pushed, or how many teraflops the system is. It's really about the overall package. And I think having fast loading, I mean, slow loading annoys the hell out of me. And I think it's definitely something that they have identified and will address next gen. So I'm looking forward to see what they come up with next gen.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of interested to see all that too. And, you know, from a big picture point of view, and it's just kind of funny to see how the whole industry has changed with all that stuff. And the one thing that I'm still on the fence about is physical media versus download, because the overall concept, there's no question in my mind. I would rather have physical media because, you know, you could play the game today, you could play the game 20 years from now, whatever. But the problem is that the physical media that you get more times than not isn't the final product. So
yeah, it hardly ever is the final product. There's always going to be a day one patch or something that some assets you have to pull off some server somewhere.
Right. So I mean, in the hypothetical where, you know, strictly limited games, limited run games comes out with a special edition of something that's the final version after it's already been out for a year with like an extra level or something, I appreciate those. But while I would always rather have just, you know, the physical copy, it almost doesn't even make sense anymore, both from a loading time point of view and because you have the physical copy. But what if you want to, you know, what if you want to play with your kids, you know, 20 years from now or something, and the networks are all down, so you can't download the latest version of that. So you end up, if you want to play the best version, you'd have to hack the console and load up a hacked version anyway. So it completely defeats the purpose. Yep.
Yeah, and I think you bring up some good points. I think that's why there'll always be a hacking and a modding community out there. I mean, as much as people want to say it's piracy, it's bad for the industry, companies lose money, I mean, it's always been the modding and the homebrew community and the hacking community that has saved games, you know, in the past. Like, if you think about like the Wii Shop, which doesn't exist anymore on the Nintendo Wii. There's so many games that are just sitting in limbo that are on that system that were never brought forward to the Switch or to the Wii U, and they probably never will. But, you know, there sure as hell is someone with a Google Drive that has the entire set of those games on the internet somewhere. And look, you could say that person is, you know, has illegal software on his drive. Okay, that's one way to look at it. But another way to look at it is he's preserved the whole Wii Shop. Right. And it's the only way you can play those games today. So is it really a bad thing that he's doing? And that's where, you know, you get into the discussion of preservation and stuff like that. But look, I'm all about it, man. Like, I think, you know, if there is a way to continue to play any game that was ever made, whether it is via, you know, we'll say homebrew or modding or hacking methods or just like you said, put the disc in the drive and hopefully it's got the complete game. I'm all for it. So by hook or by crook, I guess is what I'm saying. You know, whatever gets the job done is good enough for me. You know,
for me, my opinion, just an opinion here, and I get bombarded by angry trolls every time I say this, but there's no gray area at all for me. If you take a game and you sell it, you're a thief.
Yeah.
That's illegal. I want no part of that whatsoever. But if you just, like, I have every ROM set for every game out there, and when I need to review stuff, I always use my ROM carts. I go through a bunch of games, and, you know, once again, I'm sure I'm going to offend people, but I don't like the game Crusader of Senti for the Genesis. I played it all the way through to the end because everybody told me I would like it, and I didn't. But it's a great game to test certain things, especially like dithering effects and stuff like that. I'm not paying $300 for that game or whatever it's up to now, 100, 150, whatever else. But I also don't like it, and I'm not selling it. I'm just using it to do a quick review and all that stuff. But on the other hand, I don't, like, if a game that I love, I have to buy. And I mean, anybody, I know a bunch of people that own game stores, and they'll all vouch that I'm in there. Every time I'm in there, I'm buying something. Might be a $3 game, might be a $50 game, doesn't matter. So for me, there's zero gray area there. Like, if you steal other people's intellectual property, that doesn't matter if it's a game, or if you steal a clip of somebody's YouTube video, or if you read one of my articles out loud in your video and pretend it's your own, you're a thief. Period. But if you just download stuff for your own use, you know, share with your buddies type of thing, like I would never call that thievery, you know?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I'm very much against the person selling a console, you know, with games on eBay that's, you know, clearly illegal, that they've stolen or they've just downloaded or something. Selling stuff like that for profit, I'm never going to endorse that. But yeah, I mean, if there's something that I want to play like you, I mean, I've been testing out like the Polymega, and I've been doing a whole bunch of screen captures and playing different games. Some of them, you know, like you, I'm not going to pay $400 for a copy of, you know, Slap Fight or Bubble Bobble on the Mega Drive. I'm going to find another way to get that game to work, and whether if I'm going to burn a ROM to do it myself or if I'm going to go via other means, I'm going to try to do that because I just want that game for probably about, I'll say, an hour of my time so I can capture the footage, and then I'm going to be done with it and I'm going to move on. You know, I'm not really inconveniencing the game publishers or the authors. I'm not stealing. It's just something to get work done.
Yeah, I remember asking Matt, the creator of Tanglewood, how he felt about all this stuff. And it was a couple of years since that interview, but he basically agrees with us. Completely, you know, somebody that can't afford the game, that just downloads it and uses it. Yeah, it's annoying. You lose a sale, but there's no love lost. It's only the people that try to like sell that as a package or something like that, that it gets annoying.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you mentioned Strictly Limited and limited run games, and anyone that does physical media, I mean, usually they'll add some nice sweeteners in there to really make you want to buy a physical copy of the game. So it's not just the box and the game. You'll get like a soundtrack, or you'll get some goodies thrown in, or maybe it's a poster or something, you know, some extras to kind of sweeten the deal that, hey, you purchased this game. And look, man, a lot of collectors or a lot of people that buy physical media don't actually play their games. Like, let me put it another way. They'll put the game on the shelf, but they're not really going to play it. It's there for their collection. Right. You know what I'm saying? And that's okay too. I have no issue with that. Like, I have a lot of games in my basement. I've probably got about, you know, 1500 games across many different systems myself. So I'm all about, you know, collecting games that I like too. So there's really no good answer. Well, there's no right answer here. I mean, you know, people buy physical media for different reasons. Some people don't care that the game is incomplete, or there's literally just, you know, a code to download the game, because if you get the case and you can put that case on your shelf as part of your collection, then for some people that's actually enough, you know?
Yeah, I guess the only right answer when it comes to collecting is whatever makes you happy is the right answer. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
I hate to be cheesy and vague, right, but I mean, when it comes to collecting, that's really is what it's all about. And I have a few friends with some amazingly impressive collections, and the ones that kind of, I didn't get it at first, but Sometimes it's about just wanting to know you have the whole collection, but there's still a giant part of that that's really important to them that they play on a regular basis. So do they play all 800 NES games? No, of course not. But they like knowing that they're all there, and they do play a giant chunk of them. It's not just a collecting hobby. So,
absolutely.
So one thing I always like to ask people is, you know, how did you get started? So you said your origin story of being in the scene and everything, but I've seen your, actually twice now, I saw your presentation about copy protection and physical media and stuff like that, which led me to believe that you probably were, at least partly a nerd like me growing up that figured out how to do your own computer hacking and copy games and stuff like that. Which, by the way, if you're 9 years old copying a game, you're not a thief. You're not enemy number one. You're just a kid. So,
You just said something that made me think. Yeah, we met up twice last year at Portland and I think Long Island. Right. Man, that felt like a long time ago, doesn't it? Especially given the situation. But to answer your question, I was always a nerd. You know, like. I was always that nerdy kid that was into like calculators and like CB radios and shortwave radio and just all that kind of stuff that was going on before computers. And one day, my dad brought home a VIC-20, and it was something that he talked to my brother, who was a little older than me at the time, and my brother somehow convinced him that we needed this for the home. So one day he just kind of surprised us and he brought like this Commodore VIC-20 home with a tape drive. And I was like, whoa, what is this? You know? And so we hook it up to the TV and it's like this blinking cursor. it's like the 3 kilobytes of basic free and there's nothing there. I'm like, well, what do you do with this? But it came with this really cool manual, right? About, you know, how to use a computer, how to like draw colors on it, how to make sound effects come out of this thing. And I mean, it's kind of teaching you the basics, no pun intended, of basic, of how to write these simple programs, like type in a number between 1 to 10 or, you know, some random number generator and then slowly over time, you kind of write these like simple programs and then you kind of get a little more advanced.
Save it on your tape on your cassette tape drive.
Save it on your tape drive and hopefully, you know, you didn't record, the new AC/DC record that was playing on the radio the next day over it or something and lose all your work. But you'd get a little more advanced and you'd write maybe a blackjack program, you know, where you could kind of simulate a card table or a poker program. So you'd start writing these algorithms and maybe if you got even more advanced than that, I never got this advanced, but you could write like a chess program to, you know, to figure out how to solve a chessboard. But that's really where I got my start, man. Like I liked the VIC-20 and I started kind of coding on one. But while I was coding on one, there were these kids at school that all had VIC-20s as well, which I didn't hang out with at the time. I was hanging out with the cool kids at school, not the nerds. But I was a nerd, and I realized I was a nerd, right? So I started hanging out with these nerds because these guys had the hookup. They had like this like copying duplication thing going on. One kid would bring in a cassette. His buddy would then take it home and copy 10 games for him. So I wanted to get in on this, right? So I started kind of hanging out with those guys. And I realized at that time that, hey, man, I'm a nerd like these guys are. You know, this is where I belong. This is where I'm the most happiest, right? So that's where it all got started. Like I started copying games with these kids. It was literally schoolyard copying. Like, you know, you've heard that term maybe before, but that's how it all started. You know, I would bring my cassette in and someone would copy me, you know, Jeff Minter's VIC-20 games, which were awesome even back then. Like he did some amazing stuff. And that's kind of where it all began. And then from there it moved on to the Commodore 64 and then the Amiga. And by the time I got to college, the Amiga was still, I'll say it was still popular, but it was kind of on the way out because it was kind of towards the end of its years when Commodore was really struggling and a 386 or a 486 PC was pretty popular and taking over the schoolyard, universities and schools at the time. And so I kind of moved over to a PC and got into, you know, PC gaming for a long time, which was something that I really, really liked back in the 90s. But yeah, man, it all started from the old Vic 20 days, you know, as a kid, and it just kind of went from there. And I knew from a young age that I was always going to be a nerd. I was always going to want to do something with computers. And when I graduated from college, I graduated with computer science, and I kind of got into programming jobs pretty much immediately. At the time, there wasn't really... Computer science was interesting because I graduated from college in 94, and I know someone in the comments is going to call me a boomer, but I graduated in 94, and back then... You got to remember, man, this was before Windows 95 had come out. So, right. Like, even that hadn't come out yet. Like, there was no such thing as the internet, right? I mean, this was a long time ago. So, getting a job in the computer industry was hard because no one really knew what to do with you and no one really knew what they wanted. So, but it took me probably about 6 months after I graduated from college. And my first first job was a junior programmer job writing, porting like business software from Unix to DOS, right? Mm-hmm. To MS-DOS. And I kind of got my skills for porting, you know, pretty much from there. Like, that's kind of how I learned the art of porting stuff, you know, and that's really where it all kind of began as far as, you know, all the ports that I've done kind of stems from just learning that craft, you know, very early on. In my kind of working years, you know, I did that for about 4 or 5 years as my first job. And I realized then, man, I was kind of good at it. You know, I was good at writing code. I was good at development. I knew all the tricks. I knew hardware. I was very good at assembly language as well, which was a skill that I picked up as well in college. And I mean, that's pretty much, you know, how it all stemmed from you know, the original Xbox. I mean, by the time I had stepped into the original Xbox, I was a pretty seasoned developer. I knew how to code in C and C++. I knew assembly language. So I kind of gave myself more than a fighting chance to figure out how to port something to the original Xbox, even though I'd never done anything like that before, just based on, you know, on my kind of previous experience, mm-hmm. You know.
You know, this might be a weird question, but when you first started getting a job right out of college, at that time period, did you find it weird? Did you have an issue with any of that? Or was it because for me personally, I graduated high school in 99 and I chose like a tech school because I don't know if I have a learning disability or something, but I've never paid attention in any class I've ever been in. I would always daydream. And then when time came to learn the material, I would just throw myself into it, figure it out. Get good enough grades to pass and go. So I said, I want to go to a tech school. And I went to this school where they said, if you take the final on day one and you get an 85 or greater, you don't have to take the class. And I think I out of all of the classes, there was like 25 classes. I transferred out of 20. And they're like, you got to stop doing this. You got to take at least a couple of them. And it was both because I was such a nerd, and which was weird because you said you were the cool kid that like also gravitated towards the nerds. I've never fit in anywhere. I was a hardcore nerd. Right. I loved American football. I was terrible at playing it, by the way, but I still tried real hard. Mm-hmm. Loved heavy metal and music, but I never grew my hair out and got tattoos. So I never fit in. And now I'm at this place and they're like, all right, you have to, you know, you have to take these classes. And I already knew all the material, both because they couldn't keep up with how fast the industry was changing and because I was pretty kind of good at it. And the only classes that I was dying to take were about printers and specific ways that how printers actually work. They canceled the class because they thought no one would need to know that information anymore. So that would have been interesting. And I never got to be an expert at networking. And that was probably my own fault. But it was just, I blew through this college, if you'd even call it that, and then went online and just applied for a bunch of jobs and got one. And then, you know, a couple months later, I was supposed to be the kid who was just running backup scripts. And next thing you know, I'm this really annoying 19-year-old kid running around, you know, with free rein to run around and talk to the CEO of the company because I got to be their IT nerd. And it was actually a good time to be somebody that doesn't fit in because you're never going to feel like you fit in that scenario anyway. But it was very strange because the jobs were changing so fast. The knowledge was changing so fast. And it's still like that, but I think it was pretty hardcore at that point, you know?
Yeah, no, you said a lot of things that really kind of resonated with me. But I was I was in school, you know, obviously earlier than you were, but at the time when I was doing it, it was a lot different, but you could tell something big was coming. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like when I was in college, it was, dude, it was my first year in college for computer science. It was literally like a shed at the end of the campus, right? That was the that was the computer center, right? But by my third year there, they had like constructed this massive computer center. You know, they had like rooms full of workstations and VAX terminals and Unix terminals and PCs, Macintoshes. I mean, you could tell something big was coming. And by the time I graduated, you know, I started out learning C and C++ in college, assembly language. It was all Java. You know, like by the time I'd finished, they were teaching Java, you know, and you could tell things were happening, and there was this huge wave that was about to come. And I was very fortunate to get into computer science before that hit, because the kind of scores, the test scores you needed to get into computing had increased dramatically. And I, dude, honestly, even though I was a nerd in high school, I was also kind of a lazy kid, and I kind of just half-assed my way through and graduated high school. So I probably wouldn't have got the scores to get into computer science after it had kind of popped, you know, after I'd graduated. So I was very fortunate. I mean, if there's ever a I was at the right place at the right time type of story, it's probably that, you know. But I also feel like if I didn't go to college and learn computer science, I just would have done it anyway. You know, I would have just bought books and just, you know, self-educated myself on the concepts anyway. So, yeah. You know,
I always learn by doing. I have to just start doing something and then look up how to do it. It's funny you said that about being like a lazy kid, though. I remember my junior year of high school, about April vacation-ish, the guidance counselor called me in. And there was a whole very odd and long story that ends that there was a replacement guidance counselor. And they said, all right, well, we need to sign you up for summer school. And I went, nah, I'll be fine. She said, well, no, listen, you've been slacking a lot. You know, you would actually have to get at least an A- on every test in these three classes for the rest of the year to pass. I'm like, yeah, it's fine. They're like, no, look, we're going to sign you up. Don't do it. Don't do it. It's fine. They're like, well, if we don't sign you up, you could have to do a fifth year of high school. I mean, don't worry about it. About the first week of June, they called me in and they're like, you've got an A- or an A on every single test in these classes. I went, yeah, it's not that hard. They said, why don't you do that anyway? I said, well, why would I? I don't give a shit about any of this stuff. This is what I really like to do. And clearly I know how to do it. And the guy put his head in his hands and he goes, you're right. You're right. I don't know. I got nothing. You're right. You do you. Good luck.
Yeah, right. It's funny because it's like a reflection on them, because obviously, you know, you're a smart guy, you're a smart kid, but they don't really know the best way to extract that out of you unless you're kind of up against it. And I'm the same way, man. Like I've always said, and I say this, like my best work has always been when I'm under pressure. You know, like if I'm behind the eight ball on something, I'm going to give you the best that I've got. And that's the way I've always done things. Like I was a half-assed student at school. Absolutely. But when it came down to it, if it was time for exams or if my parents put the fear of God into me that, you know, this is it, you got to get through college, you got to graduate. Otherwise, you know, you're out on your ass. I mean, that's enough for me to, you know, to do the job that's required. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so that's a skill that I wouldn't say that I've perfected it, but I've gotten pretty good at putting pressure on myself. So it's, you know, these imaginary deadlines and these imaginary things. And it's helped on both sides. It's helped in that, you know, I get things done in a timely manner. And on the other side, I could obsess about every wrong detail in every video. And to the point where a 5-minute video would take a month and a half to do. And it's just, I put my deadline on it. You know, if there's a major mistake, I'll go back and fix it. But if not, I just leave it in there. And also I've learned you got to leave something in for the trolls to obsess about.
Which is a strange thing.
My friend Tien and I always laugh about this, but he's like, you know, you said up instead of down in 3 minutes. I was like, yeah, I noticed that too, but I'm going to leave that in so they could all obsess over that and not talk about the things that would confuse people. Because Skype delay.
I was going to say, it's engagement, man. Like, if you put in a comment in your video that is clearly incorrect and, you know, 100 comments correct you on it, I mean, they're engaged. It's engagement, you know, so I don't think that's a bad thing at the end of the day.
That's a good
you know what
point.
I'm saying?
The way I look at things, right? So YouTube forces us to be active in the comments and to leave them on. So if I'm going to be forced to leave them on, I want to try to make them a safe place for people. I don't want people associating anything I do with awfulness like that. So,
yeah.
But the other part of that too is people take a lot. I mean, a lot of the people that comment on both of our videos are smart freaking people that know what they're talking about.
Oh yeah.
So.
Oh yeah, dude. There are people smarter than me in my comments. I fully acknowledge it.
Oh, absolutely. You know what I mean? And when people go in and they learn things from people commenting, that's amazing. But the problem I have is when some people, and you know, any creator on YouTube knows what I'm talking about here. Some people are just a bit obsessive, and they just, you know, they kind of dig into things and they talk in a language that other people who are experts in the subject know, but not everybody else. So if you have a situation where there's 100 people saying you sit up instead of down, that's fine. But if you have a situation where those very smart people are talking about things that other people can't understand, you know, lag, you know, interlacing versus deinterlacing. I'm just rattling off nerd stuff here, but like it could confuse people. So I want to make sure that, like, you know, I try to create an environment where people are comfortable and would understand things. So it's almost better for me, for those people who get a little obsessive, to go off after the things that don't matter, like the word I couldn't pronounce earlier. So speaking of YouTube and all this other stuff, one thing that people had brought up before was that you're adding in-video ads to it.
Yep.
And I have a very strong opinion on that, and I'm sure I'm going to offend people by saying this, but if you want the people that you enjoy, you know, your content creators that you enjoy, to keep doing it, you should just deal with any way that they need to make extra money. And I mean, for me personally, I turned on Google Ads on my website, which I hate. I hate it. I hate that I did that. But my choice is be able to pay my rent or not be able to pay my rent. So I kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on that, because it doesn't bother me at all. But this is sort of a new thing for you, relatively. Is, you know, what do you think about all that?
Well, so you're right. It is a new thing for me. I occasionally will do a sponsored video, very, very, very rarely, and most of the time I'll get some haters in the comments, which is fine. I get it. Some people don't like the fact that, you know, you're kind of running a sponsored ad, I'll call it, in your content. So I respect that. You know, like I was probably one of those people that were telling some other content creator that I liked, you know, years and years ago, the same thing, right? But I do it in a very limited fashion. So last year I did 3 of them. And this year I've done 1. I'll probably continue to do them. Like, I'll probably pick up another couple this year, but I do them very, very rarely. I did 3 last year. So for me, the way that I do sponsored things on the channel is anything that's evergreen, which is, I'll say, 98.5% of my content, I will not do a sponsored bit on, because I feel like that kind of ruins it. You know what I'm saying? Like, if I do a video on how the Wii was hacked with a pair of tweezers, that's a video that someone 5 years from now could watch and get enjoyment from.
Absolutely.
So I'm not going to put this video is brought to you by, you know, XYZ, because that's kind of lame, you know, like I'm not big on that. I certainly don't want to see that. And so I definitely don't want to put that on an evergreen title, but something that is, I'll say, a product review or something that has like a shelf by date, you know, like if I'm reviewing, and I didn't do this, but if I was reviewing like the analog, one of the analog systems, I mean, that's something that is cool, but like 12 months from now, no one's going to click on that video because it's a product review. So I'm more than, you know, that's a video that would potentially could see a sponsorship bit get added on, you know. Mm-hmm. So I tend to not do sponsored content because I do think it's intrusive, and I'm fully aware of it, you know, when people will comment on it. But look, by your kind of angle, man, we all have to eat, you know. Everyone has to eat, man. Like everyone right. has to make money. This is a job, you know. YouTube is work, right? Like there are some people out there that, you know, will say, "Well, YouTube isn't a real job and all that stuff."
My favorite that even a few people that I would consider friends said to me
right.
is anybody with a Patreon is hold on, let me try to get the quote correct. Is a spoiled millennial living in their parents' basement trying to get paid for their basket weaving hobby.
Well, I'm not any of those things.
I know.
I'm not a millennial. I definitely get where people are coming from, but man, everyone has to make money. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if you're an adult, you need to get paid. And at the end of the day, YouTube is work. You know, like as you know, at the end of the financial year, you'll get a 1099 and you file taxes on your earnings. I mean, it is work. Now, people may turn around and say, well, why don't you just find a real job? I hear that a lot. You know, why don't you? And it's like, well, this is a real job. I mean, I tell people this all the time. You know, if you're okay with working for a shit-ass boss for the rest of your life and you know, working for the man, then great. I have nothing but respect for you. But I and many of us, you know, especially, you know, myself, I mean, everyone has their own story and situation. But for me, I'm in my 40s and you get to a point, man, where it's like, I don't want to work for anyone anymore. I want to work for myself. I have enough. I have a platform here and I have other side ventures going on where I can, you know, make a living for myself doing this, YouTube, plus mm-hmm. other things that I've got going on and be my own boss. So, who wouldn't want that? Who in the world would not want to be their own boss? And I think that's you know, the opportunities that you get. So I always tell people, look, you know, if you're okay with working for someone for the rest of your life, great. I have nothing but respect for you. But there are other opportunities out there, you know, and YouTube is one of those. So with that comes, you know, sponsored content and stuff like that. Like I said, I don't do much of it, but occasionally I will. And look, it's to pay bills. I mean, I'm not gonna bullshit anyone. I mean, the reason why you pick up a sponsorship is because you need the money to pay bills. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. So if it feels right for me, I'll continue to do it. And like I said, I don't do it very often, but occasionally I'll throw one in. I actually just did one last week, and you know, if there's another one that comes up over the summer, I'll probably pick that up. But at the end of the day, I'm fine with it. I definitely see why people don't like it, especially, you know, if they're trying just to relax and watch a video, but I don't really think it's that big of a deal and people should really just, I mean, if you don't like it, just kind of skip over it. And a lot of people, you know, usually do that stuff. So,
yeah, you know, I agree and disagree in most of those things. So I agree with everything you said, but I never minded working for other people. And that job that I had where I made computers and travel around the planet, like, I was the little fat poor kid. I shouldn't be allowed to do those things. So I would be completely happy going back to a situation like that, but I just want to be happy doing what I do for a living.
Yes.
And I love doing this. But I work, without exaggerating, without trying to blow my own horn or something, at least twice as hard doing this than I've done at any other job, including the one that I loved, where I was really working 24/7, you know, anytime the phone rang, anytime an email came in. And it's just that's kind of the thing that bugs me. Like, I would have no problem going back to work for somebody else. I just mm-hmm. want to love it as much as I love this. That's right. What's important to me.
Yeah.
You know, and when you have bad days, because we're all human, right? The best thing that you could have is where you're like, man, today sucked.
Yeah.
Like, that's a good feeling, other than like, this sucks. What am I going to do? Is it going to be like this tomorrow? Am I going to have to deal with this next week? Like, today sucks is kind of a very uplifting mentality, right? Like, oh, you know, glad this day's over, can't wait for tomorrow. Whereas I've been in scenarios before, like, there was one Like, I'm a jolly fat guy. Imagine Santa Claus with a beard, right? And there was one point in my life where I was driving to work and I started fantasizing about what would happen if I got in a bad enough accident to not be able to go to work, but not to permanently damage me. And it's like, I'm not a depressed guy. Like, I don't ever want to do that again. I don't ever want to be in that position. I just want to work and do something that I enjoy doing.
Man, I'm a little older than you, and I don't want to say I'm wiser, but I've probably seen a little bit more shit than you have. But yeah. Maybe I haven't, but I think when you get to my age, you just kind of tend, and I know you're this kind of person, you don't tend to deal with bullshit, which I totally respect that. I used to work, and I wasn't one of these people, but I would pull up into work and I would see people sitting in their cars listening to the radio, or you know, some people were just like reading a book before they would walk into the office, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, all these people are miserable. Like, they don't want to be here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they'd rather be doing something else, you know? And maybe, you know, the job that you said that you had, that sounds actually pretty cool. It sounds like a good boss, you know? Like, for me, having a good boss is one of the most important things that you can ever have when you work.
Absolutely. I still talk to this guy to this day.
Well, there you go. I mean, I've had enough shitty bosses that I've worked for where I'm just kind of disillusioned with the whole thing, you know, and it took me a long time to figure it out, but it took me a while to realize that, look, I can do this myself, you know, but I was never really a big risk taker in life, you know, in that regard. Like, I was graduate from college, get a job in computers, you know, get a good salary, work up through the ranks, and, you know, and then retire, you know, when I'm 65 type of thing. But there was a part of me that wanted more, that realized, look, I don't really want to settle for something like that. Like, there's YouTube, there's other things that I do. There's a lot of things that are going on right now where it's just like, man, you should just grab these opportunities that are presented to you and just run with it. And that's what I did. Like, I did YouTube for years as a side hustle, and I had a 40-hour week full-time job. Now, YouTube is still technically a side hustle because I do other work, which takes up more time than YouTube does. But I do it on my own terms now versus, you know, for someone else. And it's really been great, you know. So I tell anyone, you know, if you're not happy where you are, find something that makes you happy. You know, there's something better out there for everyone if you choose to look for it, you know.
Yeah, I would always rather do something that makes me happy. I'd be okay with mediocrity, but the few times in my life where it was just terrible, I think the one that really got me, and this was a youthful thing. It was in my late 20s, I think, early 30s or something, where that company I loved got bought out by a company, and they only wanted to buy us so that they could sell us.
Yeah.
So they basically wanted everybody to teach them everything they knew and then quit.
Yeah.
Because if they laid us off, they'd have to pay unemployment. So they tried to make my life miserable, and only because I'm like, I grew up that kid, you know, any Bridgeport people listening, Rourke's probably throwing his fist up in the air right now, but like, I grew up that kid where, like, if you're starting to get attacked, back yourself in the corner and keep swinging and hope you knock enough down to run away and not get completely beat to shit.
Yeah.
So I just buckled down and just was like, you're never going to get me to quit.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
There's nothing. And they tried, man. Like, a week, I don't need to get all sad or anything, but like, a week after my dad died, they sent me to a hospital in Sweden, which was badass, by the way. I loved that part of it. But like, I had to do an installation, and like, you know, anybody that's worked in hospitals, right? Like, you know, I'm in a room, I'm installing a computer, there's like some really cool 90-year-old lady that somehow spoke perfect English in Sweden, and like, 2 days later, like, I'm watching her get rolled by on the fucking stretcher, done. Like,
oh, man. Just like,
that was a week after I had to, you know, after my dad and everything. And there was, jeez, a whole other story in that. And it's like,
yeah.
And I would not break. I was like, fuck all of you people.
Yeah.
So, and they even, like, one guy, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but like, one guy even asked me what my favorite beer was. This is just to show like the type of people that sometimes you're going to deal with. So, guy, you know, I've really always loved Smittix. It's kind of like Guinness, but not quite. And it's commercial, but I love it. And he goes, ugh. People still drink that crap. And I'm like, my entire soul goes, don't punch him. don't punch him. You're in Taiwan. You're at a bar. You're in another country. Don't punch him in the face. So it was like, yeah, it was rough. I know exactly what you mean. And I'm lucky that I've only had really two scenarios where it ever got that bad. And they were short periods of time. It was a year or less. But I've known people that are still stuck in the whatever job they've had for 5 or 6 years. And it's really ruining their souls, if you believe in that. So it's just,
And again, you know, I'm not disrespecting anyone. If you're happy doing that and you've worked somewhere for a long time and you're more than comfortable, in some ways I'm very envious of that, because I was never a person that could be at a place, you know, long enough, because I'd always get bored, man. Like, I'd always look for something else to do. And you know, this is it for me at the moment. I mean, who knows? I mean, look, I'm also a realist that I know that YouTube, 5 years from now, what's the landscape going to look like? Is it going to be the same as this? Probably not.
YouTube is burying themselves. Yeah, every mistake they're doing, you know, they've done things that are absolutely antitrust violations. And somebody at some point, there's already one law firm that that beat them, and they won $100 million, which is nothing for YouTube. It's like getting me for $100.
But they're
going to crack down on some of the crap that they've dealt people. And in some of the, you know, you make the rules, you dictate how people are paid, and then you let your notification system get broken, even though you've basically lured people in to quit their jobs to work for you. You, meaning YouTube, is making billions of dollars, but then you let the very mechanism that brings all of you money break. Like, that's, they're going to get sued at some point in the next year or two. And to be honest, with people home with nothing better to do the last few months, I imagine those first few weeks, people were still kind of in shock adjusting. And now people are probably getting back to it. Like, hey, you know what? We're home. We have extra time. Let's put this together. Let's see if we could do this. So I think it's going to come full swing back at them. And I hope it's for everybody's benefit, you know?
Hope so too. And, you know, I'm a realist, man. Like, nothing lasts forever. And I'm not saying that none of us will be on YouTube in 5 years from now, but I always like to hedge my bets, you know. That's why I do other things as well. And you got to diversify. I mean, if you're going to take the risk and do YouTube and try to make some money from that, find other things to do as well. And in some ways, find other things that are more your main source of income than YouTube, which, as you know, is kind of all over the place, especially right now. It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, my only, not that I'm, I mean, by far, I am not an expert in this, but my advice to anybody, anytime they've ever asked me, is always the same. And, you know, if you're going to do anything that could qualify as the arts, do it because you love it, not because you're going to make any money. And one thing that drives me crazy is when people say there's too many podcasts, there's too many streamers. Like, listen, if you have a good time talking with two of your friends and five more friends want to see that, that's a win. That's a that's a good use of your time. You and your small group of friends have made each other happy. So do it for that. Don't do it because you think you're going to make some money doing a podcast or making YouTube videos, because that's, you know, that's not realistic.
But I totally agree, man. That's how I started. And I did it because, like you said, I had some friends that would be interested in watching some of my content. It was all garbage content, but, you know, it went from 10 views to 100 views to 1,000 to 10,000 to 100,000. I mean, it's not about, it's, if you go into it thinking that you're going to make money, because you're not, you're going to suck. I mean, you're going to suck for years until one day you don't suck. And maybe your video gets some views or more views than what you thought it would or what it normally would get. And that's when you realize, well, maybe I need to kind of, you know, hone in on this craft a little better and see if I can make this work as a business. But until you get to that point, there's no point in trying to, you know, jump in and think that you're going to make anything on the platform, because you're going to make $0, you know, for a long time.
Yeah, I still make almost nothing off of YouTube when it comes to actual, like, you know, checks sent at the end of the month type of thing. But it's completely changed the way people look at retro RGB, because for years, I mean, that's basically why I started a YouTube channel, is because for years people thought it was like a nameless Wikipedia. And they, you know, at the beginning it really was just Scott and I, and you know, I mean, we're 5 years of this at least. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting, I don't mean to sound negative, but the truth is the reason I started doing anything on YouTube is because there were a bunch of people with a lot of followers that were just reading my pages start to finish, never crediting, never saying where they got it from. And it's some, there's still a group of people that still do it. And most of them have more YouTube followers than me, which is a little annoying. I'm not going to lie, but it's just, yeah, that's where I got into this. Like, look, I like talking to people. I'm not uncomfortable in front of a camera. I'm not great at it, but screw it. Let's see what I could do. And, you know, I don't regret any of the process, because if I tried to be a YouTuber when I started RetroRGB, like I couldn't have done everything. There was not enough hours in the day to do all of that stuff. So
yeah,
I don't regret anything, but yeah, it's just, you know, it's a weird thing on how I got into it. And, you know, to be honest, if something ever happens and I have to just go back to only doing the weekly podcast, I mean, I would still do it. I do enjoy it. And I do, maybe this is a selfish thing and I'm totally okay with this, but my favorite part has been promoting people that either didn't have the opportunity to be promoted, or maybe were kind of, I don't want to use the word shy, but maybe uncomfortable to get themselves out there. I've had a few interviews where it was the first time they'd ever been on camera publicly before. And these are people that have contributed a lot to the retro gaming scene. So that's my favorite. Maybe it's a selfish thing, but the fact that I was able to get people out there and get people the recognition they genuinely deserved for the amazing stuff that they made, that's the stuff that makes me the happiest.
Yeah. Right on, man. That's awesome. I really dig that. I mean, for me, it's, there's a lot of different facets why I like doing it. Like I said, the nerd in me wants to learn about lighting, cameras, audio, all that stuff. But no, there's also the craft that goes into making a video. Like in the early days, I would literally just be like this with my phone recording myself, because I didn't realize that you could actually use editing software to, you know, to make things look a lot better. So you kind of just learn things as you go. I mean, for me, it's, there's multifacets to it. You know, there's the craft of learning how to make a video and make it look good, make it sound good. But there's also, like you said, there's definitely the human side to it too, which really, you know, is why I do YouTube for, at the end of the day. It's to put people's, you know, smiles on people's faces. I drop a video every Monday morning. Obviously, things are a lot different now with the pandemic. Half the people have been laid off. Some of them are working from home. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thought process was in, you get into work on Monday morning, you're depressed because you hate your job and your boss sucks, and there's an MVG video waiting for you that, you know, will provide you an escape for, you know, 15 minutes. And if I can make someone's day happier or make their day more pleasant, you know, for those 15 minutes, then my job is done, you know, and I'm on to the next one. So I get a lot of good feedback from people that say, you know, thank you so much for making my Monday such a better Monday. So, you know, that's why I do it, man. I do it for the people, because I think it's really awesome, you know.
Well, you have a lot of really great content that, I guess you use the word evergreen. It probably fits into that category, but it's stuff that, I'm trying to make sure this comes out the right way, because I don't want people to think I'm like throwing shade, but it wouldn't matter if you were just talking to your cell phone. Like the knowledge that you share with people is what really makes the difference. And, you know, the fact that your videos are nice to look at and you get a good B-roll to keep people strung along and, you know, walk them through the process is great. But it's really the knowledge that you share that sets you apart from other people that try to do the same stuff, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think every creator gets to a point where they're not this, and like you said, throwing shade, but I'm saying the same thing maybe in a different way, but they're not necessarily there for the content. They're kind of there for you. You know what I'm saying? Like, because, you know, you've kind of been on that journey with this person. If they've been sub to you for a while, then it's really about, you know, them just kind of listening to you versus the content. But because I get a lot of comments in my comment section where it says, I had no idea what you said in that video, but I loved every second of it. It's like, and you kind of think for a second, is that a compliment? But it is a compliment, right? I mean, they're not there like, you know, shitting on you. They're basically telling you, I really liked that video. That was entertaining, but maybe I didn't really follow along with it. But if it was entertaining, then my work is done. You know, I've done my job, and that's really what it comes down to. You know?
Yeah, at least once a month since I started the weekly podcast, there's a comment that says, I got to be honest, you know, I kind of space out and don't pay attention to most of it while it's playing, and occasionally you'll mention something that's important to me, and I stop what I'm doing, and now I pay attention. And I'm like, that's what it's there for. That's exactly 100%. That's why I do it. I don't expect everybody to be interested in every single thing that's in that weekly podcast. It's a mishmash of everything going on, but that actually makes me really happy when I hear that. And then, you know, I try to do the bigger production ones for things that that are important to me, at least. You know, which is always funny because there's sometimes you'll drop 40 hours on a video and you'll get 1500 views, but whatever. Yeah. If it's important to me, it's important to me.
So. Oh, dude, my favorite videos are probably the least viewed videos, but I don't care, man. If there's a video that I'm really passionate about and it doesn't get the views that I thought it would, I'm still happy because if I can, I'm my biggest, my own biggest critic type of thing. Like I watch my own content and I critique it as well, and sometimes I cringe because I've screwed things up as we all do. But man, yeah, my best videos personally are probably not all of them are my lowest viewed, but they tend to view less than kind of just the bigger ones that get, you know, like I have a few that have got over a million. I'm not saying they weren't fun to make; they were absolutely fun to make. But you know, if you ask me what my top five were, they're probably all of them less than 100,000 views on each of those videos, you know.
What do you think, like, in no particular order, if you could pick a handful of videos that you would say are your favorites, what do you think those would be?
Well, one that stands out was, we talked about Cody and the Xbox XBMC, so I did a story about Cody and the XBMC. That's probably my favorite video, and that video bombed. It absolutely bombed, but I went back and watched it a few days ago, and I was like, man, that was a good video. Yeah, I like that. I was happy with that. So more recently, I did one on PartnerNet, which was the Xbox Live developer, the developer version of Xbox Live, which got completely, you know, leaked and hacked and basically people ended up getting illegal development kits and basically leaking the whole thing. That was a cool video to make. That didn't really get the views either that I was expecting, but I was happy with that one. And I would say, the one that I did like last year was I did one on the analog Mega SG. I always get the Mega SG and the Mega SD confused. So it's analog. It's the analog.
Every time I talk about it,
it's the analog Mega SG.
Correct.
That one didn't get that many views because there was like 10 other creators in the ring as well, which is fine. I get that.
Right.
But I really thought I did a great job on that one. In fact, I remember you guys did a round table on it and you guys were reviewing all the videos. And I think someone, I don't remember who it was, one of you guys had said, you know, MVG was the only one that called this a clone system. And like, I was like, yeah, you know, so I felt pretty good about that one too. That was a good one to make.
That's funny. For me, it's the video capture one, direct RGB capture, because that was knowledge. I take zero credit for the knowledge. That was Arturo, that was Dark Aries, Muff, Jose, that was the R3 Wiki, it was Fuda, all the people I've been talking to over the years. But there's never been one video that walked people through it and explained why. And I think that still has like 1500 views and I don't care. I love that one. And a lot of the comments on that are, I think I might be the only person that cares about this, but this is amazing. So
yeah, right.
That's cool. How about on the other side though? How about for people that maybe have only seen whatever video of yours got picked up in the algorithm, what would you suggest as a video that, like, you know, in a good example of a typical MVG video that you would want people to watch?
Yeah, so I have different kind of aspects to my content. So there's different streams of content. So there'll be the kind of true stories of bad piracy and stuff like that, or the anti-piracy stories that occurred. Mm-hmm. So there's those. So if you're into, you know, stories about DRM and anti-piracy, anti-tamper measures, I would say check out the one that I did on the Nintendo 64. That was a pretty good one.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, more recently I did one on Star Force, the copy protection on the PC, which was absolutely horrible DRM that was in place. But there's also the kind of the more educational side about how things work. I'm a big big fan of the, you know, how the graphics worked on the Game Boy and the Game Boy Color and the Game Boy Advance. So I did a series on how the graphics subsystems work on kind of earlier consoles, which is a lot more complicated and a lot more interesting than you think, rather than just kind of drawing pixels on a screen. You know, there was a lot more to it, especially with the Game Boy, because it was such a small system, you know, very, very small amount of memory. And some of the tricks Nintendo used to basically allow developers to, you know, utilize the tile-based rendering and get really, really good graphics on that kind of system is kind of fascinating. And then there's also kind of the development side, the homebrew side. For that, I would probably say check out one of the like the 360 modding video, or maybe the PlayStation 3 modding video. So I always do a video on what's the best homebrew on these kind of older systems. So I've done one on the Wii U. The Wii U is a good one that I recently did. The Vita. So yeah, there's a series on, you know, homebrew on all these kind of more modern consoles and some earlier ones as well. So really depends on what you're looking for, but I mean, that's, I guess that's why people do like the content that I make, because I kind of mix it up with different things. It's not just the same stuff week in, week out. And I think that's, you know, one part of the channel that really, you know, appeals to a lot of folks. But I would say just check out my you know, the last kind of 12 to 18 months full of content, and you'll find something there that you like for sure.
It's funny. You said two things that cracked me up there. So first of all, the Game Boy graphics series. I really enjoyed that very much. And I also appreciated the way you presented the video. So I made the comment before and how the content you make, you could just talk into a cell phone and I would also enjoy it. That is also true, but I just felt the examples that you put up on screen during that video. There were a couple parts where you got a little bit technical, where even me, who dives deep into this stuff, I had to rewind one or two, but it still was presented in a way where I just rewinded once, and now I fully understood that walking away from it. I really enjoyed that very much, so that was pretty cool. And the thing that you just cracked me up with was, you know, any creator that constantly wants to make themselves better always says, like, you know, just watch like the past year, don't go earlier than that. Like, but dude, in actuality, you got totally good videos from before that.
I have everything from day one on there. And I mean, most creators will just delete that stuff because they don't, I'm not saying they're embarrassed or anything, but they, you know, once they kind of, I'll say, blow up and they get some relevancy, they usually put a stake in the ground and they'll delete everything before that one video that kind of blew up. And then they kind of go from there. You know what I'm saying? Which, dude, I respect that. I'm with that. But I've kept everything from day one on my channel. And sometimes I go back and watch it. And look, dude, it all sucks. It's really, really bad content. But it's also a motivator for me. And just a, you know, it's just, it's like a timeline of, this is where I was and this is where I am now. And you know, maybe 5 years from now, I'm going to watch this content and think it sucks and cringe and, you know, maybe I'm in a, you know, in a better situation with, you know, better equipment and a better setup. And, you know, that's really just the evolving process of YouTube. You know, you just kind of learn your craft and you get better at it and you continue to do it. And I think, you know, having that history and that timeline is important. And I don't think it's something that I personally am going to, you know, get rid of. I want to keep those old videos there for that reason, you know?
Yeah, you know, I am embarrassed from some of my earlier videos, but I leave them all up for all the right reasons. The only thing is, there's been one or two over the years where everything kind of changed since. So I'll change the title, and I'll put it first. You know, I'll either, I haven't had one so bad where I'll actually put do not watch, but I would if it came to that. But I'll say outdated, you know, updated, something like that, and then, I know if you're watching on Apple TV or any of like Roku or any of the TV apps, you only see the title. So I make sure to put it there. And I'll also the first line of the description. But that's pretty much it. And on the flip side of things, it does bug me when people don't do that. And, you know, a buddy of mine, you know, Mike Matei, I think you know who he is. He I had this conversation with him and he said, you know, things get weird, because if you have a video that's popular that you find a mistake, comes outdated, whatever else, if you delete it, somebody else is going to re-upload it somewhere. And then it's just somebody else is going to be making a few bucks off of you. And then there's a confusion. You don't have the control over it. And he was the one that actually recommended, like, don't delete them. Like, just add the thing. So that, from that respect, I completely get it. But there's so many videos out there. I mean, there's one, I don't even want to say this person's name, but there's one very notorious YouTuber that to this day, even though I don't even publish my email address anymore, there hasn't been a month that's gone by, or when my email was public, it was more than one a week, where I would get an email from somebody saying, hey, I saw your video on this, and I saw this other person's three videos on this, and they say it's good, so I bought it, and it doesn't work, and, you know. And some of the ones that are really heartbreaking are like, I've gotten so many that are, I'm a single parent. I wanted to play this game with my kid. Like, yeah, I dropped my last $50. And I've reached out to that person so many times. I've tried speaking to them like a human. I've tried making fun of them. I tried being a complete dick and everything in between. And they leave those videos up and people still buy stuff.
Yeah.
And the last time I spoke to them in person, which is weird because for better or worse, if I have something to say to you, I'll say it to your face. I will take my beating like a man, like I did when I was a kid, whatever. But, and they have no excuse. They just, well, you know, I put in the description that there's a newer video. Like, you can't see the description. So, you know, don't ever be ashamed of content that you think doesn't hold up to your new content, but do some diligence if you got something wrong, or if there's something that's changed that's totally not your fault. Yeah. Just, you know, take the time.
Yeah, I haven't actually done that, but I probably will go back and maybe do that. I think it's a good idea. But yeah, I'm keeping my videos up, man. Like every single one I've ever done is staying up there as long as YouTube will continue to have them, you know.
Yeah. So we've talked about your videos. We've talked about your history. Obviously, the best place to find you is YouTube. You're also on Twitter, and of course, you have a Patreon, which I am a member of. And I remember you to get into this very quickly. You posted something a little while back about wanting to do more Patreon updates and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Once again, only my opinion. I'm not trying to say this is what it should be, but it is my personal opinion that when I support somebody on Patreon, I don't want anything other than what you're already doing.
Right.
So, in fact, in most cases, I turn off notifications from Patreon because I just respectfully don't care. Like, I'm donating to these people because I want to support their work and anything else. But you did say that you wanted to make a point to do some more Patreon-related stuff. Is that something you wanted to talk about at all?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I kind of treated Patreon as it's something that just kind of sits there, and you know, people that if they want to throw some money into the tip jar, they're more than welcome to. One thing about Patreon for me is it's kind of like the sponsorship thing. I've kind of struggled with it, but the way that I deal with Patreon is I don't really talk about it. Like, I'll have a little Patreon logo at the end of the video. If anyone actually gets to the end of the video, they'll see the logo. I'll have a link in the description, but I never mention it like in a video at all. So if you want to tip me, feel free to do so. And that's the way I've always treated it. And because I've had Patreons over the years, I kind of felt like, well, maybe I should be doing more for these people versus just, you know, not really reaching out to them and you know, communicating with them. A lot of other creators will have like a Discord where they hang out on, or they'll do, you know, private chats and stuff like that. So I just kind of maybe put out the question, well, am I doing enough for you guys? You know, should I be doing more? You know, what do you guys want to see? And I think your response was the majority of what I got back. It was just keep doing, just do you, man. You know, just keep doing what you're doing. We love you and keep, just keep, you know, don't change anything. And that was very, very, you know, refreshing to hear from the folks. But yeah, I was just a little unsure about, you know, how I should be treating Patreon. You know, should it be a place where I offer, you know, more than just what I'm doing versus just, you know, it is a tip jar at the end of the day where, you know, people are, you know, support you like yourself. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, respectfully disagree with your lack of promotion. You know, like I said,
yeah, no, and that's fine. I mean, it's probably one of the reasons why. Look, I don't know where I should be as far as like Patreon and stuff, but I don't. My amount is probably lower than I'll say someone that has the same level of subscribers as myself on YouTube and the same, you know, the same kind of popularity on YouTube. It's probably way less than that person for that reason, because I don't advertise it. But I get it, man. Like I think that you know, if you do promote Patreon, then absolutely that's totally fine too. For me, it was always a struggle because when I started Patreon, I was already working at the time, so I just kind of treat it like a tip jar. And now that I kind of stopped doing work and I work for myself, you know, maybe I'll kind of revisit that and maybe, you know, push it a little harder as we go. But yeah, I mean, for me, it was just something that I just kind of set up and left it on the side. And if anyone wanted to donate, they were more than happy to. But I was never kind of promoting it in that way, you know.
Yeah, I was super apprehensive at first. I think my Patreon launch video was like 40 minutes long, explaining like, I'm sorry, but you know, something, and I obviously replaced that. But now it's at the point where like I spend most of my days helping other developers.
Yeah,
and like my choice is to promote any like Patreon and Floatplane are the main support services I'm on now, and I could promote those and then use that money to pay for my time to help all these developers, which for the record, every one of them are smarter than me. It just happens because of where the position I'm in, I have some knowledge without giving anybody's secrets away, where I could say like, you know, flip that upside down, make that interface blue, trust me on this one, like whatever it is. And I want to keep doing that as long as I can. And I could never do that in the capacity I'm in without, unbiased support, I guess, is the best way. Because if that ever went away, like hypothetically, if I got kicked off Patreon for being too fat or something, like I could not do this. I would have to take paid work helping specific developers, which would cut me off from other ones, which would suck, because there's so many amazing people out there making really incredible products that just don't know what to do with them. And I'm obviously not insulting them when I say that. It's just one of these things where it's like, I spent all my time making this. What do I do with this? And I'm in a great position to say, well, here's what you got to do. Here's who you have to talk to. And I don't take any cash from that ever. I've never taken anything other than, you know, hey, let me be the person that does the debut video for you or something like that. Which I'm shameless about. I don't care. I'll do it. You know, I'll say that. But so yeah, I have a different kind of view on that. And I see a lot of people whose content that I really enjoy that I just wish more people knew they had a Patreon. Like when I, the last interview I did with Yahel from Wrestling with Gaming, like I'd call that guy a friend of mine at this point. We've hung out in person a lot. We've done two interviews, and I didn't even know he had a Patreon until the second one. So, you know, I just wish all of you would promote it a little more, because you do deserve it, in my opinion, at least. Maybe I'm wrong, but.
No, I appreciate it. And I like the feedback, and yeah, I may start doing that now that things have changed, you know, in my life. It's definitely something that may, you know, need myself to kind of promote a little, you know, a little more than I have been in the past, for sure.
Mm. So, got Patreon, Twitter, YouTube. Now, you're part of another podcast as well, right?
Yeah. So, I actually got two right now, but the one that I do week in, week out is the Nate the Hate Show with my friend Nate, who's also on the Spawncast with Spawnwave Media. Mm-hmm. So, we basically talk about the latest happenings in video games every week. We'll do at least one show a week, maybe two. We will sometimes bring a guest on. Actually, last week we had John Linneman on from Digital Foundry as well. Right, yeah. So he came on and had a chat. So that's kind of a bit of fun. That's really more about just you know, what's going on in the world of video games. It's obviously a very interesting and exciting time right now with new systems coming. So that's always fun. I like podcasting, and I think, you know, everyone says they have a podcast, right? So it's the cliche, you know. Of course, of course, I got my own show, right? So but it's a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, so I'm subscribed to you on iTunes because, you know, once again, you know, no disrespect, but when there's long form content like what we're doing right now, I prefer to have like my earbuds in, working on something else, listening to it. I don't normally watch that. I listen.
Yeah.
So that's the main one that you have for your own personal one, right?
Yep. Yeah. And both the podcasts are on iTunes, and Look, I agree with you, man. Like, a podcast for me is always about, like, the audio. Like, if we're going to record this and if I go back and listen to it, I'm going to fire up Google Play or Spotify, right, or iTunes. I'm going to listen to it like that. Not that you're a good-looking man or anything like that, but I'd rather listen to the content versus watching it for the exact reason, because I'm usually editing a video or if I'm working on something, I want some background noise, and a podcast for me is always good background noise. Yeah.
Absolutely. For me, especially whenever I was on a long drive or on the subway or something like that, like, it was just a really great way to pass the time. You know, you get sucked into a conversation and you don't even realize time has passed. So.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, thanks so much for doing this. We got to do this at least once a year, I would think, to catch up on whatever craziness that you got working on. Obviously a big fan of yours, so this is very cool to do this. And I'll have links to all of your stuff, of course, and anything else that you'd like me to put down there. And just please keep doing you.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for hanging out with me for the last couple of hours. And, man, it's been a blast. It's been great to chat. And hopefully we'll meet up again at a convention next year.
Absolutely.